alien names. Mr. White, Mr. Blonde, Mr. Pink.
Why am I Mr. Pink?
Who cares what your name is?
Yeah, that's easy for you to say. You're Mr. White. You have a cool-sounding name.
Let's go to work.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight. I got the feeling there's something right.
What happens if the manager won't give you the diamonds?
Cut off one of his fingers. The little one.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, everybody. You're listening to a brand new episode of Tales from the Couch Zone. And as always, I'm joined by my co-host, Dazza. Dazza, how are you doing today?
I'm doing very well, thank you. How are you?
I'm doing fantastic. Thank you for asking, Dazza. Now, if that intro wasn't enough of a giveaway, we are going to do a specialty show. Our regular show, as always, will be postponed till next week. But this week, we're doing Quentin Tarantino movies. We're going to run them down from beginning to end. Obviously, there are going to be a couple exceptions where we're just going to predominantly cover the big ones that everyone's probably familiar with that he's either directed or he wrote. So let's waste no more time, Dazza, than we already have. Let's start from the beginning. Let's start with 1992's Reservoir Dogs.
Yeah, I mean, Tarantino is something that's, as a film fan, is really important to me. And apart from the fact that I'm a fan of most of his films and everything, but it was kind of a bit of a transition in my sort of being a fan of movies. Because Tarantino came around at a time when I was basically, I've always been a film fan, but I was always a sort of film fan that I would watch what was on TV. I would go to the video store, you know, go to the cinema and stuff like that. But when Tarantino came along, I was starting to basically like, you know, read about movies. You know, I started to buy books on directors. I started to buy, you know, Empire magazine. And my film interest was getting to a point where I would actually sort of like, you know, travel to different cities if it was a certain film being shown and stuff like that. And I was actually like seeking out movies and stuff. And Tarantino came around at that period. And I actually remember when I first saw Reservoir Dogs, it would have been, March the 4th, I guess 1992. And the reason why I know that is that it was actually on my birthday. And I went to the cinema with my friends, and because I basically it was my birthday, I got to choose which film we went to see. And they all wanted to see some sort of like, you know, some whatever Hollywood movie was at the time. It might have been something like Under Siege or something like that. And I'd heard about this film Reservoir Dogs, and the poster really intrigued me. And I was absolutely blown away by it. You know, I came out absolutely buzzing and everything. And the people I went with, they're less certain, like nice people, and but they weren't the sort of, their kind of interest in sort of culture was very more staid than mine. Not that I was massively alternative myself, but I was sort of open to more things, and they were basically saying, oh, that was a really strange film. Who, you know, whoever, there was no like real goodies or baddies or anything like that, and the story didn't sort of like all go together. And I came out of it and I was absolutely loving it. And I think one of the things is it's not that, you know, Tarantino came and basically was sort of like this massively like sort of revolutionized cinema or anything, but you know, that film just looked so different to everything else that I was seeing at the time. The actual look to it, I mean, I'm not a technical person, so I don't know if it's because of whatever, you know, film stock he used or anything like that. I'm not really that sort of person, but it looked different, but the picture looked different. It looked, it, you know, it didn't look like other Hollywood films. And the way the entire scenes, the way he shot, the style of it, it was just something just sort of, you know, to me, just, you know, so fresh. And I absolutely loved the story. I mean, you know, the fact that it sort of, it jumps back and forth, but, you know, there's a whole, you know, makes sense of why it does that, because you see so much of it in flashbacks. And when you get the big revelation about Mr. Orange being the cop, then basically you get the, you know, the flashbacks, or, you know, of how he got to be where he is and everything. And just an amazing movie. And there's so much sort of, you know, Tarantino, the stuff that, you know, Tarantino would be well known for. So, you know, came up in this film. For a start, the dialogue. I mean, that opening scene where they're in the cafe and they're just sort of talking over breakfast, and just, it's almost like you just sat at the table and just sort of, you know, hearing them basically, you know, talking from sort of about like, you know, Madonna's music, or, you know, the merits of tipping and everything. But you're just there with, you know, you get to know so much with the characters just by, you know, being sat and hanging around with them. And of course, there's the soundtrack, which was absolutely, you know, phenomenal. And then you also had, you know, you had stuff like the fact that I think something that's sort of gone through Tarantino's entire career, he's always had really, really good cast to work with. He's not always had sort of star power, but he's had sort of really, really great actors and actresses. Sometimes with the ones who are basically, and quite, you know, at times really sort of odd choices. You've got people who sometimes are basically, you know, starting out and like being undiscovered. You have others who have got like, you know, careers that have sort of like, you know, basically gone nowhere and sort of, you know, making a comeback and stuff. But I mean, this one, you know, Reservoir Dogs, it was like, if I've got my history right, the, you know, this was kind of like a real step back for Harvey Keitel, who'd sort of seem to have faded in sort of previous years. And this was basically, you know, a stepping stone for him, basically getting like, you know, sort of, you know, coming to prominence again. But just an absolutely, you know, amazing film. And so many, I mean, me and my friends at the time, we would drive other people nuts because we were basically, you know, reciting. We saw this film so many times. You know, we would recite entire scenes from it and sort of dialogue and stuff. And it wasn't an easy film to say, but, and probably a little bit of background in the UK at the moment. There was starting to be a backlash in the UK about violent movies. Mm-hmm. And part of this was because there was a tragedy where a little lad was, a little toddler was kidnapped by two other children. But were sort of like, you know, I think we were about 9 or 10, something like that. And they dragged this little toddler to a wasteland and they basically murdered him. And they were basically tried. And there was apparently the dad of one of them was sort of into like horror films, and he had a copy of Child's Play 3, I think it was. And the judge at the trial basically made some sort of like reference about whether the kids could have seen these videos and this could have affected him. Now, what happened then is there was this massive media backlash because of that sort of comment, but again, sort of violent movies. And Reservoir Dogs was one of the first films to actually be a victim of that, because you couldn't get Reservoir Dogs on video for a long time because the BBFC, which is like the you know, the cinema board in this country, they basically refused to give it a certificate to basically be given a video release. So it, in a way, Reservoir Dogs, because of that, got this like cult underground fandom. And they actually stayed at the cinema, you know, a lot. It was almost like the Rocky Horror thing where you would basically have like sort of midnight showings and stuff. Mm-hmm. There would basically be late night showings of Reservoir Dogs and like, you know, in small theaters and stuff. So, you know, but sort of it really sort of gave this film some, you know, notoriety, but also gave it like a real, it was almost like, you know, a forbidden, you know, pleasure sort of thing. And I actually managed to get a pirate, copy of this. It was sort of like, you know, taped from a laser disc. And when I got that, it was one of the tapes. I basically became very popular for a while because people were coming around to actually watch the tape, you know, I was a student at the time, you know, watch it at my house because I managed to get this tape and that. So, but yeah, it was like, you know, a real, you know, this was like, you know, the perfect film to come out at a time when I was basically really getting into films, but just, you know, an absolutely, you know, phenomenal film. I don't think there's a dull scene in the movie. I think throughout it is basically every scene in there is there for a reason, you know, and it just, you know, it's just an absolutely, you know, fabulous movie.
Yeah, I'm sort of one of these people that came late to the Quentin Tarantino party. Obviously, I'd heard all these great things, and obviously, I've seen all the parodies, and I mean, I've seen all the montages that people would make of his films. It wouldn't be till a couple of years later in my life that I actually got around to, and obviously, this was the age of DVD, but I feel like this is the way everyone should experience a Quentin Tarantino, especially this movie right out the gate. We're talking Reservoir Dogs in 1992. I watched it on a VHS tape, and I can't imagine watching any other way. Just, I think that's the way everyone should have to watch it, at least this film. Most of those films I prefer that's the way you watch it, just because not only obviously you're not getting the best quality, but you're sort of getting an idea of what the time was like and what most people, when they first saw this film, especially of a certain generation, most of the people that have actually seen this movie, in fact, they feel that's probably the way to go. I don't know if this is either the first movie or the second movie I've seen of his, but this is one of these movies that absolutely just blew me away. Obviously, I heard the reputation. And, just everything from, Obviously, this is one of these things that you mentioned earlier. It had this reputation of being so violent. And I guess by the time I got around to watching it, which was in the early 2000s, I imagine, you know, I was really kind of let down because it's like it got so built up. And I have to imagine even the stuff they do show you in the film, a lot of it is just in your mind. But you watch it now in sort of early 2000 eyes, and you're like, okay, this isn't that big a deal. I don't see what the big deal was. Dad, were you going to say something? I kind of felt like you were beckoning to say something real quick.
No, but I mean, you raise an interesting point there about the violence, because I mean, you know, the scene that everyone sort of, I think what one of the things that is sort of is probably more violent in this film than others is when people get shot, and it's very rare that you actually does get that. You actually, you know, you see all the blood and everything, which is something that, you know, a lot of action movies you didn't get. Because the scene that everyone sort of talks about being so violent is the basically the Mr. Blonde dance scene where he basically cuts off the cop's ear, and people sort of react as if you actually see that. And I don't know if it's because people sort of turn away and stuff, but the actual, you know, the camera, it actually you see Mr. Blonde about to cut the ear off, and then the camera does this weird thing where it pans away. It's almost, to me, it's like a breaking the fourth wall moment, because it is basically sort of showing that, you know, you are watching this through a camera, the fact that the camera sort of, like, you know, drifts away, sort of thing. So it's, but yeah, again, I think a lot of it is sort of in the, I don't know, it's like I said, it's in the imagination, and it's the sort of, you know, the intent, I guess, that a guy is actually, you know, torturing this guy. If I remember correctly, there weren't a lot of horror movies around at that time as well, so that may have basically made it a bit more powerful. But yeah, it's not, you know, by today's standards, and if you compare it to films like, you know, Saw and Hostel and stuff like that, it's nowhere near as violent as those films. I think it was just, you know, that the time that it was sort of probably a shock to the system, you know, to a lot of people at that time. But it's not, it's not a massively violent film. You know, most of it's sort of, you know, power is in the sort of dialogue and the story and the characters and the style of it. I mean, the black and white suit image, which was basically ripped straight from Hong Kong movies, which, to be honest, a lot of stuff. And in fact, I'll actually sort of come to this in a second. Were ripped from Hong Kong movies in this film, but the black and white, the black and white suits, which I was sort of, you know, thought were the coolest thing in the world. You know, whenever I got suits since, I've always tried to get, like, a black and white and as close to a Reservoir Dogs style as possible. But the whole thing, it was, you know, those came from a film called A Better Tomorrow, which is actually one of my favorite movies of all time, which is basically, you know, a Chow Yun-fat movie. And that's where Tarantino, you know, got that style from. But the actual, there's a Hong Kong movie called, City on Fire, which Tarantino actually stole, you know, and it's quite open. He does, it sort of says that, you know, artists don't do homages, they steal. And he stole great big chunks for Reservoir Dogs from City on Fire. Because City on Fire, it's not a particularly great film. But what it is, it's basically about an undercover, it's a Chow Yun-fat film again. And he's an undercover cop who infiltrates a jewelry heist gang. And he basically, and in one of the robberies basically goes wrong. It turns into a shootout where a lot of civilians are killed. And at the end, Chow Yun-fat actually, you know, the cop, he actually gets shot as well, which again is just like Mr. Orange. And then they end up back at the warehouse where the boss deduces that, you know, Chow Yun-fat is actually he's the mole, and he puts a gun at him. And obviously, one of the guys who Chow Yun-fat has befriended in the gang, he puts his gun at the boss, and then another of the boss's henchmen puts his gun at him. So you have the sort of the standoff like you get with Nice Guy Eddie and everybody at the end of that. So it is kind of, you know, a complete sort of, certain scenes were sort of, you know, ripped off for Reservoir Dogs. But what Tarantino did was basically, you know, he basically took those and made it into a great, you know, movie, was sort of, like, you know, played around with the linear of the story and everything, and just an amazing achievement.
Yeah, obviously, when people think of this film, at least one of my favorite movies moments of the film were, I forget if it was the opening scene, but it's very early in the movie when they're all sitting around the restaurant dining table and they're talking about tipping. It's just stuff like that, especially in later iterations of Quentin Tarantino movies, that I know that drive some people crazy. But that's just what I love. I love the snappy dialogue. I love the, you know, stuff that you wouldn't expect. Obviously, you hear people talk about you, but you never expect to hear in a film. So I like that because it sort of lets you know these are characters that exist in a very real world, a world that's exactly like ours. And more often than not, you often have in movies like this or similar to this. There's just it's set in this far off, wacky world, and they're more focused on what's going on in the movie than anything else. So it's like, okay, but it kind of takes you out of the film and just makes you realize, okay, this is a film. I'm watching it. All the stuff they're going to be talking about pertains to the film. So whatever, it is what it is. I'm just going to accept it for what it is. But in a movie like this, you know, you're talking about tipping and you're talking about Madonna songs. So it's like it's enlightening. I kind of like it, and it's fun, and it reminds you that these characters probably exist in a world similar to ours. And I just think that's a great way to help us relate to these characters.
And you've also got the scene with the, you know, similar sort of thing when we're in the car. And they're basically just talking about films and telling each other jokes and funny stories about people that they know. And it's just so natural. You know, the conversation, it's just, you know, they deliver it so well. But again, like you say, you know, they just sort of, you know, you just sort of, you know, and it's not boring.
No.
Because even though these are like bad people and like, you know, some of them are killers and some, you know, and ruthless people, you still like them because they're so funny. You know, then they're so, you know, they just happen to be sort of regular fun people who do nasty things for a living, you know, and it's weird because you do actually, you know, when you get the big shootout at the end and everything goes wrong, you sort of, you know, you can't condone what they've done. But you still feel bad when they die and everything. It's, you know, when it all goes wrong, it's funny. A guy should throw a guy in there who's often overlooked, or he's not in it so much, is Mr. Blue. Because he's the actor who played him was a guy called Eddie Bunker. Mm. And he actually spent he was a real life criminal. You know, he spent a ton of years in prison. And he wrote one of the best crime novels that I've ever read, a film called No Beast So Fierce, which is kind of semi autobiographical. It's basically sort of his life, but a fictionalized version of it. And that is a book I would really, really recommend. And it's got that kind of, it's something that I imagine Tarantino of reading and sort of influenced him in building up this sort of, you know, this world and everything. But just to throw that in there as well.
Okay. I think that's going to do it for Reservoir Dogs. Let's very quickly move on to 1993 with his, obviously this isn't a film that he directed, but this is a film he wrote. Now, Dazza, I have to warn you right off the bat, I haven't seen this movie. So when you start talking about this movie, realize that you're probably going to be doing most of the heavy lifting. Obviously, I heard that he was associated with this film, but just being a man growing up, obviously I see the title in True Romance and I'm instantly turned off. So let me know, and other people that aren't necessarily too familiar with this film. Obviously, I think I'm in the minority, but you never know. Talk a little bit about True Romance.
Well, True Romance was a film of, and if my Tarantino history is, if I can still recall it, this is a film he actually wrote, he wrote the script before Reservoir Dogs. And it was the intention that he was going to direct it at some point. However, he basically sort of lost interest in it when Reservoir Dogs came along. So he managed to sell this script, and it was directed by Tony Scott. And I think he used some of the money he made to basically finance and, you know, sort of put together Reservoir Dogs, as I understand it. And the film, it has a lot of the sort of the hallmarks. It is almost like, and Tarantino's admitted this, it's almost like a Tarantino fantasy. Because he actually wanted to play the lead role, which was played by Christian Slater. And the premise is that there's a, this young guy who's basically like a, he's like a movie nerd and a comic nerd and everything, but still a little bit cool. You know, he's got that sort of thing about him. He's just kind of like, you know, a different sort of guy. And he basically meets this, he's actually set up on like a blind date with a hooker who he basically, and the two of them fall in love. But he, the Christian Slater character, he basically, he kills her pimp. He goes basically to, you know, to kill her pimp, who's played by Gary Oldman. Again, this has got a great, absolutely fabulous, cast as well. Mm-hmm. And in doing so, he ends up inadvertently coming away with a suitcase full of cocaine. So he basically gets into a scam where he basically will, sell this, cocaine to basically the, he goes to Hollywood to sell it to a film director. In the meantime, the mob people who were basically sort of associated with the pimp are on the tail because they basically, you know, want to get their cocaine back and everything. And then you get basically, it's one of these where you get like sort of, it's almost like a kind of like a crime farce where basically so many other people get involved in this. The cops get a wind of it. So the cops basically send their people to sort of like on a sting to basically catch the film director buying the coke and everything. And it basically, it's a really fun movie. It's funny seeing like a Quentin Tarantino film with someone else's sort of interpretation of it. And again, there are some like really, really great scenes in this film with some really great cameos. Dennis Hopper plays Christian Slater's dad in it, and he, there's a scene with him and Christopher Walken, who basically plays like the one of the mobsters who was after Christian Slater. And they basically get to Dennis Hopper first, and they basically sort of try and torture the, you know, the whereabouts of Christian Slater from him. And there's this entire scene which is kind of a little bit uncomfortable nowadays, where basically Dennis Hopper does this speech about how all Italians are basically descendants of black people, except he doesn't say black people. He uses the N-word quite a lot. And it's just like this, it's a funny scene, but sort of from nowadays, probably quite uncomfortable and thing, but it's still a great scene. There's also another absolutely, wonderful scene with the guy from James Gandolfini. I can never say his name, from The Sopranos.
Oh, James Gandolfini, Dazza.
Gandolfini, right. I can never pronounce things like that.
Have some respect for Dead Man, Dazza.
Yeah. He basically plays a hitman who at one point catches, a pitch cricket and sort of, It's just for some, it's quite a sort of an odd movie for its time in the sort of, the plot sort of like, goes from, in some really absurd directions. You know, all these characters who basically come into it, for small times. And it all sort of accumulates from this massive, like, sort of, shootout where everyone's sort of almost like a Peckinpah film where everyone's sort of like, shooting at each other and stuff. But it was sort of, it was a, obviously after Reservoir Dogs, we were sort of like anything with Tarantino's name was sort of, got an immediate, following. So it's a really fun film. It is very much of a sort of like, you've got a 90s vibe to it. But yeah, it's, again, it's, just another Tarantino film, again, a little bit sort of farcical, how you've got this sort of like this sort of nerd who becomes, becomes this sort of badass at times. But, it's a fun movie.
All right, there you go. All right, let's move on to our next movie. Again, another year later, 1994's Pulp Fiction. Now, if you haven't seen this movie, I can't imagine you listening to this show. So, Dazza, by all means, the floor is yours. Let's hear your opening comments with Pulp Fiction. I will comment in shortly.
This at the time, this was another one which was like, a work of art. I mean, it was kind of like, it was like basically had all the great stuff from Reservoir Dogs, but the dialogue, the sort of the unconventional, plot, which basically went sort of, back and forth and everything, and the little tricks like that, but also had more of a budget, so Tarantino could basically, Reservoir Dogs was basically, done on a shoestring budget as movies went. You know, Reservoir Dogs, he had more sort of money to work with. I mean, but he used the money really, really well. You know, he had this sort of, you know, most of it sort of went into this scene in the diner with John Travolta and Uma Thurman, where they sort of, you know, where they go in there. And there's this wonderful scene where sort of Travolta's, you know, walking around this sort of, and he's basically sort of coked out of his mind at the time, or actually it's heroin that he's on. But he goes in, and he just goes in this like sort of like 1950s style restaurant, which was at the time was quite all the range. You know, even though it was in the UK, where all the waitresses would dress up in sort of like, you know, sort of, you know, 50s garb and everything. And he's walking around, and the camera actually follows him around the whole way. And it's basically to show that the whole thing's almost like a 360 set as such. And I do remember when the sort of like the word started coming out about Pulp Fiction, and they said that, you know, it was going to star John Travolta. And everyone was sort of, you know, everyone was trying to write John Travolta, because he was basically on the skids. I mean, after it's sort of, his career had gone massively downhill. You know, it dropped from, you know, and everyone sort of like thought of him of the sort of, you know, the cheesy guy from, you know, from Grease and stuff. But in this film, he took to this movie so phenomenally, you know, and him and Uma Thurman had so much chemistry. And again, you have this like massively long scene where they go out on sort of like a dinner date together. And it's a long scene where they're basically just sort of talking and stuff. But it's just like, it's so compelling as they sort of get to know each other and tell each other stories. And then we have the sort of, you know, the dance scene, which is sort of like, you know, absolutely, you know, so much, you know, fun. And it's basically been parodied so many times. It's iconic. But you know, this film's absolutely great. I mean, Samuel Jackson was awesome in it. This was sort of like the first time that I think he was sort of came across as like, you know, a real sort of, you know, he could show what he could do as an actor and everything. And, you know, I have to say, I don't think it's as complete as Reservoir Dogs, because there are a few moments in Pulp Fiction that I think, but basically there's three different stories in there that take place around, you know, sort of like, you know, the same couple of days. And one of the stories although Tarantino directed the whole thing, one of the stories wasn't written by him. It was written by his friend, and that's the Bruce Willis storyline. Which is fine when it gets going, but that story sort of drags for quite a bit. I mean, there's a scene where he's talking to his girlfriend for quite some time, and it doesn't have the same sort of energy as the Tarantino bits do. But they basically sort of talk about, you know, stuff like having a pot belly and stuff, and it feels really forced. And it's quite sort of, it slows the whole thing down. And once the scene actually gets going, it's great, because you have the sort of the whole sort of, the weird thing where they basically he gets into a fight with the gang boss, and then they basically get kidnapped by the two rapist rednecks and stuff, and it goes on this really weird this very weird sort of direction and stuff. But it's apart from that, it's a great film. But I think those bits sort of just make it not as sort of complete a viewing experience as, say, Reservoir Dogs.
Yeah. Obviously, this is one of the films I sort of mentioned it earlier, and I feel like in the same vein, it should have sort of be watched in the same way. Obviously, this film now that we're doing the show in 2016 is available on Blu-ray, and you could probably watch, I imagine, in 10K. I have to imagine this is one of the films you want to watch in VHS, just so you can get sort of a feeling of what it was like to first watch this film when it first came out, if you haven't already checked it out. But this is the film that everybody probably makes reference to. Obviously, Reservoir Dogs at the time, it was a very big deal, but when you think Quentin Tarantino, obviously the film, this is the first one you think of, or this is the one that often, that I would say he got a big following after Reservoir Dogs. That was sort of his big debut to a degree, but this is the film that really put him on the map. This is the film that really had everybody talking about him. And then when he would go on to make movie after movie after movie, this is the one that people would often cite as the Quentin Tarantino movie. And like I said, I think we discussed this on earlier shows. I mean, a friend of mine is also a big fan of Quentin Tarantino. So often when we mention facts like this, I may mention them in and out, but is it true that, some of these stories weren't necessarily written by Quentin Tarantino?
No, I think like I say, one of the Bruce Willis story wasn't written by him. That was written by his friend Roger Avery, who was a guy who he basically sort of, you know, went to video store. He basically worked in video stores with Tarantino. And Roger Avery became a sort of director as well and stuff. But he, I think he did a film called Killing Zoe. I think that was one of his issues. So it was very much like a Tarantino movie, but just didn't have the sort of the same sort of spark to it. But yeah, he wrote the Bruce Willis storyline and Tarantino wrote all the rest of it.
Ah, okay. Yeah, I heard stuff like that before, and you were kind of critical at the time. So it's like I know I have a best friend that's also very giant fan of Quentin Tarantino. So often I forget who tells me what. But yeah, this is one of those films that obviously when people think of Quentin Tarantino movies, this is the one that everyone thinks of. I love the way that the narrative sort of just bounces around. I think it's a very cool technique. Obviously, you would see it to lesser effect in other films, and I have to imagine this wasn't something that he created, but this is something that often when I think of that style of storytelling, this is the thing that really comes to mind.
I mean, there's some great, when you mention that, there's some really great clever tricks when they do that, because they start off where they sort of in the Reservoir Dog style suits. Mm-hmm. And then they turn up at the bar and they're wearing like the t-shirt and shorts and things. And it's kind of like, okay, what's happened here? I mean, it's not until later on in the film where it sort of goes back that you actually get to know, you know, what actually happened in there. It's really fun because you put the whole thing together and it's just sort of like, you know, there is one long narrative that sort of works in that, but you have to see it in this disjointed error in, way, manner to actually, you know, appreciate the, you know, the actual, all the sort of like story little things in it. But yeah, I mean, it's like, you know, John Travolta gets killed halfway through this film. And then because of that sort of narrative, you basically get to sort of like, flash back in it, you know. So yeah, it's a really cool thing. I mean, one of my favorite scenes in it is the Christopher Walken scene.
Oh yes,
where he brings the watch to the little lad, and he has to, and it starts off as this like really, really like heartwarming scene. And to be honest, I don't know whether it was Tarantino or Roger Avery who wrote this, because it fits into the Bruce Willis story, but it feels more like a Tarantino piece to me. Mm-hmm. He's telling this like sort of this like really heartwarming story about how this watch was bought by his great 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 grandfather in like the First World War, and how it was passed on to his son who also went to fight in war. And it's this like heartwarming story how it was passed on through a generation. He tells him a bit about his history as it goes along, and then it comes to his sort of his father who was captured in Vietnam with a watch, and how he basically, and then he just goes on this absurd direction where he tells him that he kept the watch up his ass.
I thought the way it was explained was it had to, the watch was passed through multiple generations through having to do that. Am I imagining that?
You're imagining that.
Oh, okay.
It basically starts off where it was like, you know, it was basically for all the generations who fought in the previous wars, but then it was his, the little lad's own father was actually captured in Vietnam. And to basically keep it from being confiscated and stolen by the Viet Cong, he basically kept it up his ass. and then he died. And so before he died, he passed it to Christopher Walken, and Christopher Walken shoved it up his ass. So he basically, you know, so basically the watch was up, you know, and then at the end of it, he's after this sort of, he's told this sort of story, and then goes, and now I give the watch to you. it's this really, you know, this wonderful scene that sort of, you know, goes on this absolute way. And I remember seeing this in the cinema, and the entire audience just absolutely fell about in hysterics at the store. You know, because it was just so, you know, and Christopher Walken sells it so well. You know, and he sort of just sort of go, you know, matter of factly tells him that it was like shoved up his ass and stuff. But yeah, it's absolutely a wonderful scene. The business as well with what's in the suitcase, which, you know.
Yeah, we talked about this at the earlier show. Let's sort of reintroduce. I'm sort of one of these people where it doesn't matter. It's not super important to the story. So when people speculate about it, I'm just like, whatever. It doesn't matter. It's not important to the story. And then really, I've heard some over-the-top things, and it's like, well, they really haven't established that in this movie so far that it's, you know, this realistic world, and suddenly they're going to have this something that's in a suitcase, and that's the thing that everyone's going to sort of be the supernatural MacGuffin. It's like, no, it's probably it doesn't really matter because it's not super central to the story. Tell people what your theory was or what you've heard over the years.
Yeah, I mean the most common one and my particular favorite one is the idea that it's some sort of there's a scene where you stood behind Marcellus Wallace and there's like a scar on his neck, and the idea is that that's some sort of operation, and what's in the case is actually his soul. So he's somehow had his soul removed, and that's why he's trying to get the suitcase back. Mm-hmm. And there's sort of like it's actually a reference to there's a B movie, I think it's like Invaders from Mars or something. And in that film, where basically people are basically captured and then sort of like possessed by, you know, by aliens, and the way they do it is to operate them through the neck. So there's some sort of the speculators speculate that that's basically what that is a reference to. It somehow he's basically sort of had his soul removed or something, and that suitcase is basically, you know, is what's been taken, and that's what he's trying to get back. It's obviously something which is recognizable, because Tim Roth, when he sees it, looks at it, but he goes, is that what I think it is? And that, but yeah, you're right. It is just a MacGuffin, but it's nice to see these, like, you know, little clues and look out for things, especially with somebody like Tarantino, who he's never revealed what it is, or even if he actually knows himself, but there's always that thing that maybe there is something in there. I mean, the whole thing in the suitcase as well, with the glowing suitcase, it's sort of, you can basically trace it back to there's a film by Alex Cox called Repo Man, which and there's a scene in that where basically there's a subplot where for much of the film there's a car that has basically something glowing in the bonnet, which whenever anybody looks at, they basically get like disintegrated, you know. So there's sort of, and there's a I think it's a Mike Hammer film, I forgot which one it is, but there's a scene in that where an object that they're trying to get that sort of glows. It's basically been, some people say it's, you know, plutonium, which obviously, you know, you can't really see that being in a suitcase. But I think it's with something like Tarantino, who is basically influenced by, you know, movie history and stuff like that. But, you know, but the fact that he's left little clues in there, I think it's just sort of, you know, a fun little thing for people to actually sort of speculate on. I mean, people try to speculate on what Reservoir Dogs actually means, the actual title to the film, you know, but no one's ever sort of, you know, I think it's just a cool name personally. But, yeah, I think it's, we'll never know for sure. Well, maybe we will know one day.
Well, I have to imagine, maybe, obviously, now that we're discussing this, obviously the news has come down the pipeline that Quentin Tarantino has announced that he'll do two more movies and then he'll retire. I wonder how long that will last, but maybe at some point he'll explain to us what happens once he retires. Or maybe to help promote one of the movies that are coming out, he'll explain what it is. And everyone on the internet will shut up about it. But yeah, that's Pulp Fiction. Absolutely instant classic. Moving on to this very same year, Natural Born Killers in 1994.
Yeah, I mean, this one's got quite the history as well. Basically, this was one which was written by Tarantino. I don't know actually when he wrote it, but it was another script that he basically wrote and sold. And it got picked up by Oliver Stone. And this film was kind of, like I say, it had quite a history about it, because this one was actually banned in the UK. Again, it's not quite banned is the wrong word, but the BBFC basically refused to give this one even a certificate to be shown in cinemas.
Ooh.
Yeah, so you could not see this film in the cinemas, which again, basically, if you sort of deny people something, you basically immediately create sort of, you know, a demand for it. And I think maybe it was, you know, even sort of like, small, like, what we call movie clubs, you know, sort of, where basically there's sort of like, you know, clubs, like film societies where they were basically, would sort of like, you know, have showings of films, like even they couldn't show it. And it was sort of in, I basically remember this because there was so much controversy about it. I remember falling out with a friend over this film, because I really wanted to see this film because I was sort of like a Tarantino, you know, fanatic at that time. But also, at the time, there was a hell of a lot of sort of, you know, violent movies, which were basically, it's not that I personally liked, say, violent movies. It was just that for a cinema fan, the sort of movies that was sort of doing really creative stuff and daring stuff and just sort of like were good films just happened to be ones that were basically had like lots of violence, you know, to them, like, you know, Pulp Fiction, Reservoir Dogs, but also were films like, say, you know, Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer. There was a film called Man Bites Dogs, and there were a lot of films which were way more violent than Natural Born Killers. But for some reason, Natural Born Killers got banned. I think part of the reason was there was some sort of copycat murders. Well, people claimed there were some murders that were basically straight copycats from Natural Born Killers. Mm-hmm. Now, Natural Born Killers at the time, I actually managed to get a pirate video copy again. And it was a really, and when I watched it, it was sort of like, you know, a really poor quality film, and the color scheme was out and everything in certain films was really weird. It wasn't until years later when I actually managed to see the film. And for a long time, I don't think it ever got released at the cinema. And on DVD, it never got released on video for a long time, but it actually strangely cropped up on television. And when I saw it for the first time, which wasn't on the pirate, I realized that all these weird color schemes and everything were actually part of the film. Because Oliver Stone did this like really weird, sort of trippy, surreal look to the film. And there was sort of like a bit of a fallout between Oliver Stone and Quentin Tarantino, because Oliver Stone changed quite a few things about the script as directors that I want to do. And there was this massive, when you actually saw Natural Born Killers, it wasn't that great a movie. It was interesting in certain areas. But it was, I mean, I personally found, if you don't know what the story is, basically this is kind of, there's a young couple that meet, Mickey and Mallory Knox. They actually basically meet, get married, and she comes from like an abusive family life. He's basically a criminal, and he kind of rescues her from this environment, and the two of them basically go off and pretty much just go off on a kill spree. You know, they get into a car and they basically just sort of, you know, go along Route 66 and just murder him the way as they do. And they become sort of like they get like almost like a fan following, which actually, you know, happens in real life. We sort of, you know, you'll see people who are basically like fans of serial killers, believe it or not. You know, we'll sort of like, you know, we'll wear Charles Manson t-shirts and stuff like that. And I've actually seen, when I was a student, I knew a girl who had a calendar of serial killers.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah. And there was someone else who I knew who used to collect trading cards of serial killers and
stuff.
I've
seen those before, yes.
Yeah, they'd have statistics on the back, so it's telling you how many kills and how many years life sentence and stuff like that. And yeah, so it basically sort of, there is kind of like a satire on the media with it. The only trouble is, because it's an Oliver Stone film, the satire is very, very in your face and sort of unsubtle. I mean, this is a guy who basically, when he did Wall Street, he named the lead villain as Gecko, you know, just in case you didn't know he was the bad guy. So, you know, he's Gordon Gecko and stuff like that, you know, and it's so heavy handed. I mean, some people, there were a lot of Tarantino fans at the time who tried to say that, Tarantino did a really, really great script and that Oliver Stone ruined it. Now, I've actually read the script to Natural Born Killers, and it is very, very different to the film in some places, but the general gist of it is it's not that much better of a story.
Okay.
You know, I think part of the thing is Mickey and Mallory Knox, apart from the way they dress, are really dull characters. Mm-hmm. They're really sort of, you know, they're really dumb, they're really annoying, they're basically like sort of like killer hippies, you know, they talk bollocks all the time, they're really uninteresting as characters. But the best things about this film are actually the characters around them, because you've got Robert Downey Jr. who plays the guy who runs a TV show based on serial killers, who wants to get an interview on a live special in a prison with Mickey. And it's during that that basically there's a prison breakout and they manage to get free and everything. But Robert Downey Jr., I think, again, this was Robert Downey Jr., he managed to, this was kind of like his stepping stone back into sort of like, into cinemas or Hollywood's good graces, because he'd basically fallen into the sort of a drugs and everything trap. And Tommy Lee Jones played a prison warden in it and was sort of gave a real good thing. So there's some really good stuff in there. And there's some sort of like, you know, cool little things with the sort of, you know, with the media and stuff and things. But on the whole, it's not a great film. I have to say the script, one of the things I would say which were differences between the script and the film is, the script was a lot more, although the violence was about the same, the script went into a lot more about what Mickey and Mallory did on their murder rampage. And whereas in the film, they basically see, they're seen as sort of having shootouts with cops and stuff like that, and there's a few kidnappings. In the book, there's sort of in the script, I should say, there's a lot to do with them having these what we call the slumber party murders, where they will break into homes and kill like sort of, you know, teenage girls having slumber parties and stuff. So there's a lot more nastiness in the actual film itself, but than in the film. And there's also a weird bit which has actually been edited, where basically they dropped from the film because it was considered too violent, where Mickey and Mallory they basically break into these famous bodybuilder's house and they basically saw off the bodybuilder's legs.
Oh, God.
Yeah. But it turns out that the twist is that the two bodybuilders are these... they actually like Mickey and Mallory for doing this because it basically gave them a challenging life. It's this really weird, trippy scene, but it was edited. It was one of the first scenes. For me, it was an introduction to the fact that not everything that you saw in the film was everything that was filmed, but there were sort of scenes that were cut out because there was all these pictures of this sort of notorious scene, which had been sort of like, you know, left on the cutting room floor. And that's when I sort of, as a film fan, started to realize that, you know, there was stuff that was basically filmed, but you never actually got to see. But as a film, it's kind of, it's an interesting film in some respects, but it's ultimately not a particularly charming film by any stretch of imagination. And mm-hmm. when I actually managed to sort of get to see it after all the years of sort of waiting and everything, it wasn't something that I was sort of like, you know, wasn't really worth the wait.
That's a shame to hear, Daz.
All right. Have you seen it?
You couldn't just let it go, could you? No, I haven't seen this movie, Daz. This is another instance where you need to clutch your pearls, Daz. I haven't seen Natural Born Killers. I didn't even know this was a Quentin Tarantino film. Obviously, I'd heard how great this film is, and I've seen clips of it here and there because I own cable, but I've not seen this film. Daz, are you happy you embarrassed me in front of all of our friends?
You're not missing much, to be honest.
Oh, that's a shame. Well, from one film that I haven't seen to another, it wouldn't be till 2 years later that we wouldn't get another Quentin Tarantino movie of sorts in 1996's Till Dusk, Till Dawn.
Yeah, I mean, this again, it wasn't one that he directed. He wrote this and his friend Robert Rodriguez, who was... he was another director who came about at this time, and he sort of... he was basically sort of, you know, also in with the sort of like the, you know, the independent, filmmaker and such. And Robert Rodriguez actually wrote an absolutely tremendous book. And I forgot the title. I think it's Rebel Without a Crew. And in it, basically because he made a film called, El Mariachi. Mm. Which was this absolutely splendid film that he made for about like $9,000. It was this sort of absolutely wonderful action film. He pretty much, I think he shot it on video instead of film, but he wrote this book about how he basically made this film. And he actually, to raise the capital to actually make the film, he actually spent a month, as a guinea pig for experiments, you know, like the medical experiments. You know, testing like drugs and stuff. He actually spent a month doing that just to get the money to finance the film himself. You know, so Robert Rodriguez, you know, absolutely sort of, you know, really, I think he's sort of almost like a forgotten at times, sort of, you know, in Tarantino's shadow. But, you know, in many ways, he's sort of, is as good as in his own way. You know, he absolutely, you know, wonderful filmmaker. And he basically sort of, you know, directed, From Dusk Till Dawn. And this is just a really, really crazy film. It starts off like a Quentin Tarantino style movie in very much in the sort of way of sort of Pulp Fiction, where you basically got, two brothers, the Gecko brothers, played by George Clooney and Tarantino. And this was basically George Clooney's first film after, you know, when it was basically a TV star from ER at the time, and he basically became his film and was so charismatic in this film. You know, they basically play these sort of these brothers who are basically escaped from the courthouse where sort of one of them was basically up for on trial, and they're basically sort of, you know, bank robbers. And they, it starts with them sort of robbing a convenience store, and they get into a shootout with a sheriff. And it's and they're basically sort of, you know, they're on the run. It's a road movie, and they basically kidnap this family to get across the Mexican border, which they do. And then they basically decide to, basically spend, you know, the night, at this bar called the Titty Twister, which is just this like really, really, you know, wild bar where there's sort of strippers, and it's like a biker hunt and everything. Unbeknownst to them, this is actually a trap for a vampire gang who basically, you know, they feed off truckers and bikers and that sort of thing. So on one hand, you've basically got this like sort of this crime thriller, and then it just sort of like within a space of like 5 minutes turns into this basically this battle with all these like, you know, really ridiculous vampire creatures.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and it is it's a bizarre film. It's a lot of fun as well. Mm-hmm. You know, particularly when it gets to the vampire scenes, because you've got these sort of like these wonderful little characters that come along. You've got this biker called Sex Machine, who has this sort of this codpiece with a gun in it, we're shooting vampires with. And it's just a really, really, you know, fun movie. One of the sorts that you can sort of watch, you know, after a few drinks and everything, you know, just a really sort of like, you know, just a totally wild film, basically.
Yeah. You, that's pretty much you nailed it in the head. It starts off as a sort of this, you know, this sort of mystery film, obviously, with all this crime, and then it just turns into this horror movie. It's like, you're fine with the pivot, but it's such a hard pivot. It just comes out of nowhere. But, yeah, it's a really great film. It's an absolute classic. Obviously, you know, it's one of these films where I recommend everybody check out, especially we did a show not too long ago with our top Halloween movies. Obviously, this film didn't make it on any of our lists, but I'm kind of a little ashamed that we didn't mention this as part of our honorable mentions, because this is actually, in fact, a very good film. They replay it on television all the time for a reason. It's a really good film. This is another film that, when Halloween comes around, helps get me in the mood. This is one of these films I know Quentin Tarantino was attached in some way, matter or form, but I didn't know it was to this capacity. So when people mention Quentin Tarantino movies, this is obviously not one of the first ones that comes to mind, but the fact that he was so intricate to the screenplay, it's like, okay, I get it now. This is a really good film.
Yeah. And it's got like sort of like a good sort of B-movie sort of cameos in it. It's got Fred Williamson, who was in a lot of blaxploitation films as a Vietnam vet, and it's got Danny Trejo, I can never say his name, Trejo, in it. Cheech Marin's in it. Yeah, it's sort of, you know, it's just, you know, it's a kind of, a, you know, you got to switch your... switch your brain off for quite a lot of this film, and you know, but yeah, it's you know, it's a lot of fun.
Very much so. All right, from here we're going to move on just a year later in 1997 with Quentin Tarantino's next movie that he directed, Jackie Brown.
Yeah, I mean, I really love this film.
Yeah, you know, really don't hear enough about this film, and it's really a crying shame, because really it's on par with the rest of the stuff he's done. Obviously, he doesn't have any of the iconic scenes, or there's none of the iconic memorable lines, but really, when people mention Quentin Tarantino films, obviously, either this is just mentioned in passing, but really, this is, I think, up there with some of the best.
I think the reason why it kind of gets looked over is it doesn't, it's for a Tarantino film, it's very down to earth. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not got the sort of like the really wild characters that the that his other films have, or the sort of like, you know, the sort of, it's not got those sort of, you know, crowd pleasing sort of one liners or anything like that. It is a very sort of like, you know, grounded film. But I think in many respects, I think it's quite refreshing for that, because it still has, you know, great dialogue in there. There's some real great scenes and some great characters. I mean, the Samuel Jackson character, you know, the Gambos is absolutely sort of great. Jackie Brown is a character I absolutely love, especially because she's like a strong female who basically has this sort of, you know, this, she basically in this film, she pretty much outsmarts everybody. Mm-hmm. You know, she outsmarts the police, she outsmarts the, you know, the criminals, and she goes off into the sunset with all the money and everything. You know, I think she's like, you know, she's a wonderful character. You know, and Pam Grier again, you know, it's sort of, I mean for Tarantino, it must have, this, it, when his career got going, this must have been like a wet dream for him to basically be able to sort of reach out to all these sort of stars of the 70s and 60s and stuff. And somebody like Pam Grier was this, you know, this iconic legend of the whole black, you know, of blaxploitation movies and everything. To basically have her, you know, in one of his movies and everything. And again, some, you know, an actress who had basically you'd not seen for some time, you know, in sort of, in any sort of significant roles to get this sort of, you know, this role. But yeah, I mean, and it's quite, this is actually quite an unusual one, because the, although it was actually, you know, written by, Tarantino, he wasn't actually his story. The story's actually based on a novel by Elmore Leonard, who, if you ever read any Elmore Leonard, he was basically doing Tarantino before Tarantino, as it was. He did a lot of westerns, but he also did a lot of like really, really cool crime dramas. He did one of his books is a book called Swag, which I absolutely adored, about a guy who was basically, you know, sticking up, sort of like shops and stuff, as you know, this was a novel by Rump called Rum Punch that Tarantino bought the rights to make into a film. And but yeah, I personally think this is, you know, a real, really fabulous film, and sort of like, you know, and sort of, you know, but like you say, it doesn't quite get the love, you know, when you talk about Tarantino, as what a lot of his other films do.
Yeah, obviously, a couple of days ago, I didn't know the way this show was going to work. I thought it was going to be like very, very reminiscent of our Halloween show, where we sort of go over our favorite Quentin Tarantino movies. And to everyone's shock, I was going to put this as my favorite Quentin Tarantino movie. I know that may take you for a loop, Dazza, everybody else too, but this is one of these films where I watch it. I, you know, at the time I had no idea that it was a Quentin Tarantino movie, had no idea that it even existed. Went and watched it and was absolutely blown away. Now, this may have been an instance where, obviously, I've never heard anything in this film, so I went into it kind of cold. Obviously, I knew while I was watching it as a Quentin Tarantino movie, but no one had ever made mention of this film, so I just naturally assumed it was a bad film. And I watched this film, and I was absolutely enamored. I was like, wow, this is a fantastic film. This is obviously on par, if not better, than most of the stuff I've seen from Quentin Tarantino. So this, I'm going to tell, I know, I realize I'm sort of blowing my wad here, but as far as just of all the Quentin Tarantino movies, this is the one that's absolutely my favorite. I just like it because like you mentioned earlier, it's so grounded. It's not over the top. You don't have this premise of a film that's completely, you know, absurd to a degree. It's just this very grounded, realistic story, and I just love the character work and the story work he does in this film. This, more than any other film, I felt like he just takes his time, tells the story that he wants to tell, develops the characters the way he wants to do it. And to me, it's a fantastic film. It's one of these films that it's a sleeper hit. Now, obviously, people mention it when they mention the pantheon of films that Quentin Tarantino has either directed or been attached to. And this is just the one that just I not seen coming. And it's obviously, I will say this of the film, if I could be just a little bit critical, it is a little slow and it feels really long. But it's one of these things where it sort of does feel like the epic, where you're watching it and it's not super fast paced as the other films, but at the same time, it's like, okay, that's fine. He's telling clearly a different story here, and Quentin Tarantino has built up enough goodwill that I'm willing to give him the benefit of the doubt, and it really does pay off in the long run, because this is one of these films that just, it emphasizes more than anything else character work and just not really too concerned with all the wacky shootouts. It just, It's telling a certain story with certain characters, and it's just absolutely fantastic, and I love it.
Yeah, yeah, and also quite, you know, moving in some ways, because the sort of, you know, the guy who she works with at the end when they sort of like say goodbye, even though they've basically just been working with each other, you know, as a on the job to basically sort of, you know, to get this money, and he's somebody that she's sort of. I think he's a bondsman. That's how they meet each other. And there's like a really moving scene where you feel that there's some sort of like affection between them, certainly on his part. But they sort of, you know, they go their separate ways, and it's just like this kind of like, you know, this subtlety. There's nothing really outsaid. It's just all just the expression, a moment. And I think it's sort of, you know, it is you know, a really, really great film. It's one that people, I think, you know, should. You know, definitely revisit. And I think in many ways it's the one that sort of, because it's sort of so grounded, mm-hmm. and it's not sort of, it doesn't lend itself to being sort of like, you know, what is considered cool and fashionable of the time, which I think some of the films, you know, can date when you do that. But with this one, I think it does have that sort of, you know, I think, you know, in another like sort of 20, 30 years time, you can look at a film like Jackie Brown and it sort of still have it sort of, you know, it still be sort of have a timeless quality about it. It won't look too out of place. Whereas I think some of these others, you know, will probably sort of, you know, may not be sort of, you know, pass the test of time quite so well.
Yes. Okay. I feel like we're going one end of the spectrum to the complete opposite. Obviously, we're talking about a story that's very grounded, very realistic. To 6 years later, in 2003, we had Kill Bill Volume 1.
Yeah. I mean, I really, really like this film. I think, well, that from this point on, you see sort of Tarantino starting to. I mean, there's always been some things like self-indulgent about his films, and from this point on, you can see almost most of his films are sort of him, basically sort of indulging his sort of passions for certain genres and stuff, which is fine if you're directing, you can do that, you want to do that, so, you know, that's, you know, perfectly fine. But this one obviously is kind of his homage to martial arts movies. And I think he does it really, really well, because he's basically able to sort of, because martial art films are in themselves pretty much outlandish and quite crazy and sort of over the top, Tarantino doing one sort of feels like a natural fit, because he himself is sort of, you know, he's sort of able to sort of, he's basically able to indulge that sort of like, that really sort of way out sort of, you know, bonkers side to him. And I really absolutely, you know, love this film. But then again, I'm a big martial arts film and everything. You know, I love like the homage to Bruce Lee with the Uma Thurman's suit that she's wearing. And, you know, the whole sort of, the whole revenge aspect to this film, I think is that, you know, absolutely sort of, you know, wonderful. And there'll be all these little sort of tricks that go into this film. Like, for example, when it goes on to the origin of the Lucy Liu character, and it basically becomes a manga for about 15 minutes. And then you've got that sort of that massive fight scene in the bar and everything. And also a really, really cool soundtrack and everything. And not just with this one, but the soundtrack's great, not just because it's basically taking a lot of sort of, like, you know, really great songs and putting it to a film. In this one, there's like a really good score to it. You know, the whole sort of like the pipe music that runs through it at certain time really puts into, really evokes the sort of like, you know, the mood of sort of like, of martial art movies as it was. But yeah, I really, really love this film. And apparently the sort of story goes with this, and for a time I didn't really believe it, because it really didn't sound how films work, but it's how sort of, you know, it's the story that sort of has come out of this, is that Tarantino shot so much footage for Kill Bill that basically they decided, rather than sort of edit lots out to make a running time, that they would basically split the film into two volumes. You know, so, you know, but, which. You know,
I don't think it's just that, because that's sort of something obviously now would be a great place to talk, as we're sort of, you know, talking volume one, eventually going into volume two. I think he divided the films not just for runtime, but it's also, this is something I noticed when I watched volume two. When I watched volume one, it was very much sort of that over the top action fest, action, for lack of a better term, action spot fest. And then for the second film to be the complete opposite, obviously at the time I was expecting more of that in Volume 2, and I like you just mentioned, I just assumed he just ran out of time, and that's what Volume 2 was going to be as well, sort of an homage to different kind of action styles. But I think he divided the films also not just because of runtime, but also because both films have a very different vibe. Obviously, you mentioned earlier how one is very much this over-the-top, I would say, cartoon, whereas two is sort of this grounded, more realistic film that's heavy on the dialogue, not so much the action. So I feel like that's the reason why he decided to make it into two separate films, not just the running time.
Yeah. I mean, you're right. We might as well talk about Volume 2 while we're doing Volume 1, if you know. But Volume 2 also has a lot more of basically goes into her backstory. You know, it shows her how she basically trained, how she became a martial arts expert and everything. And those scenes as well really, really go into the martial art scenes, because you've got the mentor who's almost got these like magical powers at times, which I think some of those scenes were cut from the film, but there's certain scenes that actually show him sort of almost like flying and spinning around and stuff, which is like a very Hong Kong style movie. But I know a lot of people are sort of disappointed with the second one because it didn't have the big iconic battle scene that you got in the first one, where that sort of that relentless sort of fight where she would be crazy, the crazy 88 or something.
Yes,
and and in this one, it's basically there's just the sort of, you know, she battles the Michael Madsen character and then battles the Daryl Hannah character, and then she finally gets to Bill and everything. But yeah, I really thought this this saga, you know, worked really, really well for what, you know, for Tarantino's style. You know, it fitted in totally, you know, with what he did as a filmmaker. I mean, the opening scene where she turns up at the house and basically just gets into the fight with Black Mamba, and it's just a real, really sort of, you know, grabs you by the throat and just sort of, you know, guides you through the film from that point on. But yeah, you know, it's I personally like both parts to it.
I mentioned earlier they're both very different Jurassic films. I think it's one of these things to where time has been more forgiving of the difference between the two films, if anything. I notice, obviously, you could sort of study the anecdotally, it's like, well, from what I've heard and what I experienced, people tend to like two a lot better, but I can sort of prove it, because I notice often on cable television, they'll often show two over, I mean, sometimes they'll show them both back to back, but more often than not, if a cable station is going to be hard pressed to just play one, I often think they're going to go in the direction of Volume 2. Obviously, I'm going to play devil's advocate here as well. But maybe because of the violence, that's why they play only Volume 2. But I think 2 is more substantive, and I feel like it's the better of the two films. That's just my opinion. I don't. Daza, do you have any one opinion one way or another, or are you somewhere that's down the middle, or do you prefer one, or do you prefer two? Or I'm curious to see where you fall on the spectrum.
Of the two, I probably watch one more than I do two.
Okay.
But I think that's basically, and I think I just really, really like the action scene and I think there's more sort of like fun, iconic moments in there. Whereas, I think what sort of lets me down with Volume 2 is, I think when she finally gets to Bill, I find it almost an anticlimax. Because she and it's sort of because she basically sort of, you know, the whole conversation that she has with David Carradine, I think this was the first time when I think Tarantino his scenes with sort of like his like big monologue scenes and dialogue started to grate with me somewhat. I think it was, you know, when they get together, I expected something more from her final confrontation with Bill, and we sort of got that sort of like that really awkward conversation about Superman comics.
Yeah,
you know, when she starts saying, when she's talking about sort of, you know, the Clark Kent and everything, and just that whole sort of you know, that sort of like battle of, you know, dialogue between the two, I just found really, really sort of it just kind of was like a bit of an anticlimax for over the time we've invested in it. Plus also, I always found it really, really weird, and I've never really understood this, is throughout the film, it, whenever her real name is mentioned, they beep it out.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I sort of, I basically always thought that when we actually find out her real name, it's going to have some sort of like revelation to it. You know, whether it's to like an existing character or somebody that we already know or something like that. And then when she sort of, you find out her name is Beatrice, it's like, so what? You know, why, you know, and I guess it's, I know there's sort of this explanation that up to this point, she's kind of like a character with no name. Mm. And so it is not until this point that we actually, but she basically has her own character as such. But, you know, because she's just known as the Bride. But I just sort of, it was kind of like an anticlimax. It was like, well, what was all that beeping out then? What, you know, I don't get it. I have to say as well in this film, I think one of the people who really steals the show out of all these actors and actresses, and which is a real surprise, is Daryl Hannah. I think her character in this, you know, is absolutely phenomenal. I absolutely sort of adore that character and her performance. And Daryl Hannah, she's not somebody that you immediately think of as being like a film stealing star, but in this one, I think you know, she to me was a real standout.
Yeah, I can sort of see where you're coming from with this. I can't say I had the exact same opinion, but I can certainly see where you're coming from.
And there's also at the end, see, the thing is that there's always been, Tarantino sort of hinted that he would return to this story. And he had the idea, because there's a scene early on where Black Mamba's daughter, sort of, and incidentally, that scene was really weird, because the little girl sort of comes into the kitchen and sees her mom there with Uma Thurman sort of like stood over with a knife. And the kid takes it really, really calm. She just sort of like, she just like stands there, and Uma Thurman gives this speech to her about how her mum had it coming, and she said, if this is still sore, when you get older, I know, I'll be waiting. And apparently Tarantino had an idea that if the two kids in this film, but Uma Thurman's daughter and the Black Mamba daughter, that sort of like years and years, you know, in about sort of 20 years time when we were grown up, if we were, had an inclination to be actresses, that they would basically do a storyline based around those two kids and have the two kids play them. You know, sort of like, you know, sort of like another revenge movie with Black Mamba's kid going after Uma Thurman for, you know, for everything. And you also leave it open with Daryl Hannah as well, because when it shows you the list at the end of all the characters and across the name through, Daryl Hannah's got like a question mark through her. Because she doesn't actually get killed. She basically just gets blinded and left in the trailer, you know. So there's always the chance that she could be like a blind character that sort of could come up earlier as well. So, you know, and maybe we could get that, I guess, sort of, you know, down the line. But, yeah, this was to me, you know, a really fun couple of movies.
Yes. Now, you mentioned earlier how there was that, and you, at least in your opinion, I would agree. I would disagree. And say that it had different, I liked it for different reasons, but, you mentioned, the monologue with Bill and sort of how it was sort of, you thought it was a little dialogue heavy. So I'm curious to see where you weigh in on our next film, 2007's Death Proof. Obviously, this was originally packaged as a half of the movie Grindhouse. So I'm curious to see where you weigh in. Are you one of these people that absolutely hate this film? Hate the scenes where they're at the diner and the scenes with the talking? Are you one of these people that, you know, take it for what it's worth, and maybe, you know, maybe you're like me, you absolutely love it. I'm curious to see where you weigh in.
Oh, you're stolen my thunder there. Death Proof, okay, here's the thing about Death Proof. Death Proof is kind of like a, you know, a funny little gag in certain places. Okay, basically, if you've not seen Death Proof, it was basically him and Rodriguez, basically, they did a film each. And the idea was that they would do a homage to the Grindhouse cinema, where it would basically be a double bill with sort of trailers in between. And both films would basically be sort of like a Grindhouse style film. Now, before I actually move on with this bit, I do have to basically, I want to plug another podcast here. If you are basically interested at all in Grindhouse movies, there's a podcast called Radiodrome, and which is basically a really good movie podcast in its own right. But there is a series of episodes which are called Grindhouse Purgatory. Mm-hmm. And they have got a guy on there called, I think he's, 42nd Street Pete, who was basically a guy who lived through the Grindhouse period and basically was sort of like involved with the cinemas on 42nd Street, which is basically where the whole Grindhouse movement was. These episodes are absolutely fascinating. You know, and so anyone who's into film history or alternative film or anything really needs to check out these films, because I could listen to this guy talk for hours. He's absolutely fascinating about how, where they got the films from, the history of the films, what the culture of the theatres was like, how dangerous it was. He also talks a bit about Tarantino and pretty much thinks that Tarantino is full of shit when he talks about his own Grindhouse film. But I'll leave that to the podcast if everyone's interested. But going back to this... this also to ground the Death Proof part of this little package. It's kind of like a cool little gag. It's basically emulates this sort of the degraded film style, because with Grindhouse a lot of the films would be passed from cinema to cinema. So basically the quality of it was always like watching pirated videos, because they would basically get damaged and degraded. There'd be scratches on the film, and also the films themselves weren't greatly produced. So you would have scenes where there would basically be like, jump cuts, and you would have sort of bits where you couldn't hear the dialogue great, particularly if you were doing outdoor scenes and stuff. So there's lots of really, really little cool gags in there. There's also a gag at the start where the title to the film flashes up, and then almost immediately you see a title, and then the Death Proof title is basically jumps over it. It's basically placed over it. And what that was a reference to was you would get a trick of sort of some of the Grindhouse movies where if a film was really, really got really bad reviews, mm-hmm. and was sort of like, and cinemas didn't want to take it on, they would basically re-release the same film but with a different title. To sort of get around that. So that's kind of like a gag based on that. And that's what the film, for the most part, actually is. Just lots of little sort of like, sort of gags sort of thing. The thing is, to me, that is a gag that works well in like a half-hour little featurette. It doesn't hold my interest for an entire movie. And Grindhouse, I think, is a really, really dull movie. And I think the dialogue scenes in there just absolutely, for me, drag. The stuff in the coffee shop where where the girls are talking, and they're telling the girl about how they've basically done this radio show competition for her to give somebody a lap dance. It just goes on and on and on. And it's just sort of, then the scene with Kurt Russell where he's basically talking about whether to put the girl in his notebook about sort of chicken shits. Again, that just goes on and on and on. And I just sort of, the whole movie to me, it just felt like a massive, massive self-indulgent mess. And I like the idea of doing this Grindhouse type movie, but these sort of Grindhouse films were in some ways were that way for a reason. And to sort of try and emulate it and sort of like be a homage to it, it just, for me, the entire film, I really, really didn't like.
I'm curious to see where you weigh. I mean, before I had to go off on your opinion, but I'm curious. Did you know they released both these films separately on home video? They released obviously you could watch they released it both ways. You could sit there and watch the Grindhouse film, probably you would watch it the way in theater, and then separately they sold longer cuts of both films. Were you aware of this, Dazza?
I wasn't, and I mean, just to let you know what it was like in the UK, because the Grindhouse film, the whole thing was such a flop in America, mm-hmm. in the UK, we didn't get that. You couldn't actually see the whole package together because it was basically, it was too long, and it was just sort of such a flop in America. But what they did in the UK is basically, they just came across as two separate movies.
That I wasn't aware of. Yeah, in America here, they did a version where like you mentioned earlier, and I think you know because you mentioned it earlier, it was shorter cuts of both films, and then they interspersed it with trailers for all these fictional movies, yep. Which obviously we've seen some of them now, like Machete have actually been actual films, but yeah,
Shotgun with the hobo,
hobo with a shotgun. That I didn't know that was based off of a Grindhouse trailer. Supposedly, I keep hearing Thanksgiving still in the works. I haven't seen anything to indicate one way or another. But, I didn't know that's how they released it in the UK. So have you seen the entire film as the way it was in the United States, where it's sort of these edited down versions of both movies and it has the trailers in between?
No, I've never seen the full Grindhouse movie as such. I've seen both films and I've seen the trailers on YouTube. When I went to see Grindhouse, they did have the trailer for Machete on there. Mm-hmm. So Machete was, I think and I could be wrong on this, I think they might have even done an interval for Death Proof where they actually placed Machete in the middle of it. I could be wrong on that, but I'm pretty sure when I went to see it, that Machete was basically, it was either Death Proof or it was in, is it Planet Horror?
Let's
Rodriguez one?
Yeah, I know what you're talking about. I think it's Planet Terror.
Yeah. Planet Terror, yeah, that's it. Yeah, the Machete trailer was shown with one of those films anyway. But yeah, you basically, you couldn't watch the whole ensemble, which I was really disappointed with because I was really looking forward to seeing the whole thing as one. And then basically when it came to UK, it basically came as two separate movies. I think they were released a few weeks apart from each other as well. So you couldn't really even like do the trick of going to see one film and then going to see another one straight after. It was a separate viewing experience. But yeah, again, the scene at the end where you've got the girl doing the stunt where she's on the car, that I appreciate the sort of the gag there because a lot of films, and I don't know if this is actually something that you would sort of get in the Grindhouse movies, but you would get in films like Russ Meyer movies where you would get like a really, really overlong scene. That sort of, you know, it works as kind of like a gag, but I just think the whole film, as a film itself, just doesn't work for me. I can appreciate the sort of the jokes and everything, but to sit down and watch the entire film, I just thought was kind of like, you know, quite tedious. I think Planet Terror was a lot better film because it had all those little tricks. It did the thing with the missing reel, and it had all the sort of the interference and that. But it was also an enjoyable film on its own. Whereas Death Proof, I just thought was a load of gunk.
See, that's where we're going to disagree. I absolutely love this. And this is people that feel like Quentin Tarantino on steroids, everything that they hate. And I'm sort of the 180 of that. This is everything I love about a Quentin Tarantino movie. Just characters sitting around a table, all interacting with each other, obviously making stuff to you reference to in real life, and then obviously this film to a degree, talking about other stuff. But just, this is what I like. I know people are critical of this kind of storytelling where, to a degree, all the characters sort of sound like Quentin Tarantino, and I'm sort of fine with that. Obviously, when we go into other mediums with Brian Michael Bendis and comics, I hate that thing, but for some reason why, when Quentin Tarantino's writing dialogue and it's just that, and we've seen this in other films like Reservoir Dogs and obviously, like you mentioned earlier, Kill Bill Volume 2, I'm one of these people who are guilty. I'll hold my hand up and be like, I love it. I absolutely love this film. Obviously, Jackie Brown, my number one, but if I have to go with a number two, I'm going to go with this as well. Cause it's just, I know Dez is shaking his head, but for me, I don't know why. I can't explain it. I just love that kind of thing in a film where it's just really great dialogue. You feel like you're just sort of a fly on the wall. It's like this great conversation. It's like, oh, I can watch that all day, Dazza.
Yeah. But that's the thing. I don't think it is great dialogue because I think it's basically just overlong and just sort of not really talking about very much. Whereas, you know, in Reservoir Dogs and Pulp Fiction, they're having conversations which are fun and that you can get into. But this one, it just sort of, it was almost like, oh, get to the point. You know, so, but I have to say that, you know, the whole Death Proof marketing, even though it didn't work because the film wasn't, you know, a big success. Mm. I had a Grindhouse poster on my wall because I loved the Death, you know, the whole sort of how they recreated the old fashioned posters and everything. And the sort of, you know, I loved a lot about it. It was just the film to me, you know, didn't deliver. But, you know,
shame, Dazza. Shame. This film's great. No, I realize I very much realize I'm in the minority. There's very few people that like this film. Obviously, there are people who are more forgiving of Kill Bill Volume 2, at least from what I experienced anecdotally. But I understand I'm in the minority as far as people that like not Planet Terror, Death Proof. So I'm willing to let that one go. As far as being in the minority, as far as something is concerned, I again I'm going to put myself again in there saying I'm not a gigantic fan of 2012's Inglourious Basterds.
Oh, okay.
So yeah, it's just one of these films where, you know, you expect a certain story or a certain way of storytelling from Quentin Tarantino, and I feel like this is just the complete opposite. You're obviously not dealing with a 70s, 80s, 90s culture where this is the complete 180 opposite. You're dealing in Nazi Germany with a bunch of U.S. troops, and that's sort of, and obviously the people living in Germany, Nazi Germany as well. That's the focus of the film. It's like, okay, that's sort of, we're not used to that kind of storytelling from Quentin Tarantino, so it's a little jarring, but then at the same time, it's just like, I could see how it's one of his films, but I'm just not a super fan of it.
Okay. Here's the deal with this film, I liked it a lot better when I watched it the second time around. I was really brought down with this film because for years, from the Pulp Fiction days when Tarantino would do interviews and everything, and incidentally, part of the thing that appealed to Tarantino wasn't just his films, but the way he would actually talk about his films with such, you know, in interviews and that. It was more like a down-to-earth video store kind of guy, as opposed to the sort of like the rather aloof film directors and everything. But in any case, back in those days when he used to do interviews, he would always talk about how one day he was going to do a Men on a Mission movie. Now, I love Men on a Mission movies, stuff like, you know, The Guns of Navarone, Where Eagles Dare, films like that. I absolutely love. And then when he finally said that he was doing it and he did Inglourious Basterds, I thought, you know, this is going to be great. And the thing is, this to me doesn't doesn't have the things that I love about a Men on a Mission movies. The thing about Men on a Mission movies is you always get a squad of soldiers who all have their own who have personalities, who you get to know, have backstories. There's always sort of like some sort of like interaction, you know, sort of like, you know, some sort of, you know, either camaraderie or some rivalry between people in the squad. Well, as the film goes on, you will basically get members who will be killed and everything and that. In Glorious Bastards, you don't really get to, although there's a squad in there who are sort of on a loose mission, you don't really get to know many of the characters. You know, you get to know the Brad Pitt character a little bit, and there's the guy with the baseball bat, and there's the other one who were basically sort of, you know, killed Nazis with his knife and everything. But generally speaking, it's not a straight, you know, Men on a Mission film. And the story, I think, as well, is quite an uneven one. I mean, there's some great performances and some great scenes in it. I mean, you know, Christian Waltz was absolutely phenomenal as the Jew Hunter in this. That scene at the start, and again, when we talk about like long dialogue scenes, I actually think that scene at the start is absolutely fantastic. And he is so terrifying in it. And he pretty much talks just the whole time. And it's just, it sets up that character in it is just, you know, so well done right from that very opening scene. But the story, you know, it goes off in tangents and takes a while to really get going. And the scenes like the, you know, there's the scene in the bar where they have the rendezvous, and Michael Fassbender comes into it, and he really does very little. You know, he comes on, he has this like weird briefing, and then he sort of goes and takes, you know, command of a small unit for a short time in the film. And then you get this shootout that kills, you know, most of the characters that you've sort of got to know quite sort of, you know, they're basically sort of slaughtered en masse, so you don't really sort of get to have any sort of like, you know, emotional attachment to the actual scene and stuff. And it's just sort of, I don't know. I like the film in places, but I think on the whole, the story just sort of, you know, jars from one thing to another. There's no, but there's a lot of really good performances in it, a really good characters, but I don't think it all gels as well together as, say, Pulp Fiction, that has lots of stories and characters going on, but also to cross each other's path and mingle. This one doesn't, it doesn't fit all together as well for me, this one. And I mean, you know, props to having the surprise moment where they actually managed to assassinate Hitler. I mean, that's a wonderful scene. But when that actually happened, because I was sort of watching this thinking, well, Hitler's obviously going to escape, or, you know, the mission's going to go wrong, they're all going to get caught and everything. But no, they just barge in and just, like, gun down Hitler, which I thought was, phenomenal.
Yeah, a friend of mine had noticed, obviously he's a big fan of Quentin Tarantino, so I feel like it's sort of necessary that I bring this up. He made an interesting note for this film, something I've never heard from anyone before. But the film, obviously, there's this part of the film where all the Nazis are in the theater and they're watching the propaganda film of this one sniper, right? And yeah, they're all cheering and hooting and hollering when they see the brave Nazi soldier in the tower sniping off the Allied forces. And so they're sort of just, they're encouraging it. They're having a good time. They're saying, yeah, you take it to those Allies. While at the same time, he's sort of this meta scene. It's like you're watching it, you know, you're watching the Nazis watch this propaganda film, but at the same time, you're watching this propaganda film of the Americans and they're slaughtering these Nazis. And it's like, well, you could sort of say from like an objective point of view, it's like, well, what you're doing is sort of no different what the Nazis are doing in the film. It's they're watching the glorious countrymen fight against the evil foreigners. And it's like, well, you're sort of getting that in the film because it's like you're having these inglorious bastards. So obviously right off the get-go, they're telling you these people are terrible people. And even the stuff that they do to the Nazi soldiers are absolutely horrific. But at the same time, I guess because they're Nazis, it's sort of forgiven. But at the same time, on sort of for a human level, it's like, okay, you could just kill the Nazi soldiers. You don't have to scalp them, or in several instances, they do these horrific deaths. It's like, okay, I can sort of see now where my friend's coming from and the meta point of view. It's like, it's a propaganda film within a propaganda film. Do you see that, or am I just obviously he sold it to me, and I think it's a really good take on the film, but is that sort of just blowing smoke, or do you get that interpretation as well?
I think my what you've sort of said just highlights another problem that I actually have with the film. I don't know if this actually confirms or denies your friend's theory, is that it's really hard to have any sympathy with the team, with the bastards. Mm-hmm. Because they are such, like you say, they basically just do such despicable and cruel things to the enemy. And I don't think it gets a pass because they're doing it to Nazis, because the Nazis themselves are probably the more sympathetic people, because there's that scene where they basically caught several of the Nazis and one of them, where basically sort of all he wants to do is basically go home to his mother. You know, because he's, you know, because let's face it, you know, a lot of the Nazis, not all of them were like, you know, Gestapo or SS guys or anything. Some of them were basically just like, you know, conscripted into the army. Mm-hmm. They'd no choice. And that sort of, you know, for me, there's certain, you know, there's certain depictions of the Germans in this is basically just, you know, just your common ground soldiers who were basically, you know, who they're scalping and they're, knifing the Nazi insignia on the foreheads and everything. And it is quite, obviously, you know, when the Jew hunter gets his at the end, you've no sympathy for him at all. But there's always that scene where the German officer who we've captured and he's refusing to basically, again, you know, another German who basically you see in sympathetic terms because he refuses to give details of the locations of his sort of, his like comrades. So they do this long scene where the guy basically taunts him with the baseball bat and basically just beats him to death with it. And he basically just sort of, you know, through it all, he just kind of like just takes it with real bravery and dignity rather than actually sort of save his life to give up his fellow men. You know, and so, you know, to me, you know, it's hard to sort of, to sort of have any empathy with the bastards, or even want them to sort of like, you know, sort of, you know, to do well. I mean, even Brad Pitt, he actually sort of, you know, he tortures the woman on their side when he thinks she might be a traitor. He basically, he puts his finger into a bullet wound in her leg. You know, it's sort of, it's, many films, you know, you don't have to have, like, you know, goodies and baddies, or, you know, sort of, or heroes and villains in there. You have your shades of grey, but, you know, to me, but there's not a lot to actually, you know, to root for in this movie, personally.
No,
again, I like a lot of the movie. It just, I think, you know, the story, you know, there's certain bits of the story that just sort of doesn't piece together all that well.
No, I agree with you that, and I think of most of the Quentin Tarantino movies, I think this is on the weaker end of the spectrum of the films that he's done. I'm curious to see what you think of 2013's, I almost pronounced it the way it's spelled, Django Unchained.
Oh, God, right, okay. This one is really critically acclaimed. I believe, I could be wrong on this, I believe it got nominated for an Oscar.
In my opinion, it's very good.
For the spend. I personally don't like it. I really don't. And again, this was another film that this time it was Tarantino's film, time to do a spaghetti western, which I love spaghetti westerns. I thought Tarantino doing a spaghetti western, this is going to be absolutely awesome. I found this film for the most part really, really tedious. Mm. I think certainly there was particularly when it gets, okay, here's the deal. I have never walked out of a film in the cinema in my life ever. Okay.
Wow.
There's only been a couple of times when I basically wanted to leave a film early, not because I was like appalled by the film or disgusted or offended or anything like that. There's been a few times when I've wanted to basically get up and leave because I wasn't enjoying the movie. I wanted to go home. This was one of those times, and I didn't. I stayed to the end because I always have a thing that, you know, I always stay to the end of a film, no matter how bad it is. But this one, I just went towards the end. I just found it so absolutely tedious. The scene in particular where they have the dinner with the Schultz character and with Leonardo DiCaprio, I just found it absolutely dull as hell. And I was just sort of thinking, oh, get to the point. I didn't even really know what the whole purpose of this was. I know we're sort of, you know, trying to get the girl back and everything, and we're trying to outwit the guy. I just found the dialogue absolutely tedious and dull. As opposed to Inglourious Basterds, where the opening scene is like really tense and you're sort of wondering what's going to happen. In Django Unchained, I just got to a stage where I just wanted the film to end. And after that, there's kind of like two different false endings as well. I just found the whole film really, really dull and tedious, absolutely, and really did not like it. I don't know why it got such accolades and why it was sort of, you know, loved as much as it was. I personally would never want to watch this film again.
Wow. Okay, we've had disagreements before going back and forth. Obviously, we mentioned Grindhouse earlier, but this is something I'm a complete 180. I love this film. You mentioned tedious. I will agree with you as far as this is concerned. You mentioned tediousness. Now, towards the part at the end of the climax where he shoots up the house, is proceeded to get caught, escapes, and then shoots up the house again. And it's like, okay, I can see where you're coming from as far as that's concerned. Because I'm like, you know, aside from that one part, I told my friend who I watched this with at the time, I was like, aside from that, this film was flawless. I absolutely loved it. I felt like that choice of him getting caught and then coming back just to shoot the house up again. It's like, well, had you cut that out, I feel like this would have been a perfect film. But I cannot agree with you less, Dazza. I absolutely love this film. Think it's fantastic. Obviously, when you think of Quentin Tarantino, I'm thinking this kind of film, but this is I don't know where you're coming from. This is a fine, fantastic film, and I can see why it was nominated for Best Picture. It's a really good story. It's obviously not super convoluted, which also, you know, earns it plus points too. But I really like the simplicity of the story. You didn't like the character played by Christoph Waltz, which he won an Oscar for with the Dr. King Schultz. I can see how you can hate that film, but there's no way you watch that film and you don't like that character.
I like that character, but I just found basically the story was so slow as it went along, and I think that sort of that like final like act or acts towards the end, I just sort of lost my patience with the film and just got really bored. Listen, I like him as an actor. I really, really like Leonardo DiCaprio. I was really excited for Leonardo DiCaprio to be in it, because he was probably at that stage probably the most high profile actor to be in a Tarantino movie. And I sort of, I really have a lot of time for him as an actor. But for me to get bored when you've got those two in the scene and also Samuel L. Jackson, I just found the whole thing just a really, really tedious affair. When Tarantino cropped up in the scene after, when he's doing the Australian thing, I'm not a fan of Tarantino as an actor. Anyway,
okay, we won't get a disagreement from there either.
Yeah, I think it was okay in little bit part in Reservoir Dogs, and even in Pulp Fiction, I think in the scene is the guy in the dressing gown, I think it was fine and funny in that. But in the later ones that I kind of lost patience with it, in this way, it's doing the Australian accent, I really got annoyed by it. It was just sort of, it just felt again really self indulgent and really annoying, and him going back to, when he goes back to shoot up a place again, by this time I was just like really, really bored. I didn't care if he died. I didn't care if he got the girl back or anything. I was just done with this movie. But I just found it a really sort of, again, I keep saying tedious. I just found it really, really slow. And the story in itself, the idea of the story, I liked. I just thought it was just sort of done in such a slow pace. I don't think it needed to be that long. The only scene that I sort of really enjoyed, because I just thought it was funny, is the scene with Don Johnson when he's the Ku Klux Klan guy. That scene there I thought was funny, especially with the guy who was complaining because his wife had been making the masks all night. That whole sort of little storyline there I found really, really fun. But generally speaking, the rest of it I just found sort of like, it was like a no-lose situation. You had a film which was about basically bounty hunters in Wild West times. I thought, how can you fail with this film? And I just found the whole thing just sort of slow, slow moving, and just was not a fan.
I still can't believe it. I'm flipping through. Obviously, I was like, well, let's see. Maybe Daza has a point here. So I'm obviously flipping through IMDb photos here of the movie, and I'm like, no, Daza, I disagree with Daza. No, I absolutely love this film. Were it not for that redundant scene towards the end, it's like this would have been the perfect film. So this is one of these instances where we're just gonna have to agree to disagree, because it's like, I'm curious to see where other people weigh in. I think once I post this show, I'll see if we can try to get some interaction from people, because I can't imagine anyone not liking this film. So the fact that my buddy who I do a podcast with, we're doing the Quentin Tarantino movies rundown, it's like, you don't like this film? Wow.
Obviously I am in the minority. I mean, I don't know what the Rotten Tomatoes is rating, is it? Because I have very little stock in that sort of thing. But I'd be interested to see what other people think. But I'm looking now on people's top 10 lists on critics. It ranks quite highly and stuff. So, but yeah, I personally just did not get it.
How many times have you seen this film now?
I only saw it but once.
Maybe that was one of these instances.
That was enough. That was enough. Actually, no. I tell a lie. I did. I saw it in the cinema, and I did start watching it on TV once when it came to Sky, and I basically didn't last the whole movie.
I see. It'd be so easy for had you not liked Jackie Brown too, I'd be like, well, this just proves that Daz is a giant racist.
Oh. Not at all. It's just this isn't,
No, obviously I'd be joking, but it's like it'd be so easy to do that. It'd be so awesome.
Oh
Okay, from here,
there were a lot of sort of backlash from certain groups about this sort of this film anyway. So, you know, particularly,
God, who cares? I was it the use of the N word? Because I know this was heavily this. I think was that one of the controversies of this film.
It may well have been. Okay. It may well have been. Yeah.
All right. I'm curious now to what you think of 2015's Hateful Eight. Hateful Eight. I said that right. I wrote it wrong though.
Okay. Hey, Hateful Eight. I actually, I think this is kind of, I really enjoy this. I won't say it's sort of back to, you know, back on form or anything like that. But to me, of these sort of like is more recent ones. This is the one I have the most time for. You know, I think it's got all the sort of the hallmarks of what I really liked about the early Tarantino films. The narrative is basically non-linear, but it's done so with a purpose because there's some like twists of what's actually going on in this very small surroundings. I love the cast. I love the little sort of interplay of sort of, I like the whole idea of basically them all being together. And basically, obviously, from the start, there's something going on, but you're not quite sure what, and the revelations that come in of it and everything. I really, really like this film, you know, and I was really, really enjoyed it. There's certain things that I don't like about it. Personally, the treatment of the girl character, particularly, and I'm not going to spoil this for anyone who's not seen it, but the actual what happens to her in the end, I really found uncomfortable, basically because it was just sort of done so. It basically just went on so long that her fate, it was just dragged out so much, and I just had a hard time watching it. It got to a stage where it was kind of quite exploitative and really salacious, and I even though she was a villain character, I really, you know, that I really didn't like. And also, you know, she takes a hell of a pounding in this film when, you know, it's, you know, Kurt Russell was sort of at one point the hero, you know, is constantly like, you know, punching her every time she speaks and stuff. It's quite, you know, abusive, but then again, it's from the, you know, the time you've got to put into, you know, the characters that you're actually dealing with. But generally speaking, I really, really enjoyed this film. You know, I think to me, this is kind of like the film that I wanted Dan Django to be.
It's just Django Danza. I made the same mistake too.
Yeah, this is the one that I sort of, you know, that I wanted that film to be. And it just sort of, you know, this was more like, it basically played more into the sort of Western type thing that I like. But I just thought this was a great film. All the different characters in it, you know, Michael Madsen, Tim Roth and everything, and Bruce Dern, they all basically brought something, you know, brought something into the movie, you know, and it was basically like it was almost like, I won't say it's a spoof of The Magnificent Seven, but it drew on that sort of thing where you have all the very different aspects of sort of the Westerns in there. You've got, like, you know, the loner, you've got the sort of, you know, the gambler, the alcoholic and that sort of thing. This one had that sort of thing where each one of them was kind of like a stereotype of some sort of, you know, Wild West characters. And, you know, I absolutely, loved them for this.
Yeah, I'm looking at the list of films here, obviously, because we had to pick out what we're gonna do because there's so many things that Quentin Tarantino sort of has his thumbprint on, or he had his fingers on. So we had to, before the show, we had to figure out what we're gonna do. But I'm looking at the list of films here, and I'm obviously, we're at the very end here. We're talking Hateful Eight, and obviously I'm looking at the list of titles, and I'm like, I'm looking at Inglourious Basterds. I'm like, he kind of missed the boat because it's like this is kind of a film you'd expect to call something like that, because it's like, yeah, everyone in this film is absolutely deplorable. There's obviously shades of just how terrible everybody is, and I feel like that would be a more appropriate title considering the way that this film winds up going, and the way that obviously the numeration obviously wants you to realize how many characters are involved in this film, but I feel like Inglourious Basterds would be more fitting of a title, just how absolutely terrible, and for the most part, just everybody in this film is irredeemable. So it's one of these things where it's like, oh, he kind of missed the boat. That would have been a more clever title. But yeah, I sort of agree with you. This is a great film. Obviously, there's opening scenes of the film where sort of it's done outside the cabin, but I would say 90% of this movie is done within the confines of the cabin. And if you had told me they would have been able to do that in a 2016 film, I would have told you, you'd be like, eh, that sounds kind of boring. That sort of sounds like a play to a degree. But I guess just with Quentin Tarantino's camera work, or just the way he would manage to at the end tell the story, it's like, yeah, actually wound up being pretty good. And obviously you can't ignore the fact that it's all taking place within the confines of the cabin, but at the same time, it's like, it doesn't really bother you and it doesn't really take away from the film. If anything, it just adds to it. And I'm curious to see if, now obviously I'm sure it wouldn't be cheap, and I'm not sure if Quentin Tarantino would sign off on this, but it'd be kind of cool if they adapted this to a play. Could you see that going well, Dazza?
I think it'd be perfect for a play.
It is sort of, you know, that story. It is a film that, aside from maybe a couple of scenes here and there, I'd say 90% of the film takes place in that cabin, and it's like, you could get away with doing this as a stage play.
Oh yeah, definitely. Definitely. It's, you know, and it's, you could see that, because in some respects, that's kind of, you can do the same for Reservoir Dogs, because there are actually some groups that do Reservoir Dogs as a play. It's normally like amateur dramatics type thing. And I know in Vegas there's a show from time to time that they do, which is basically an all female cast doing Reservoir Dogs. You could, this would work, you know, really, really well as a play. You know, the thing is as well, this just something that, you know, you talk about the length of the film. This film's almost 3 hours.
Oof.
But the thing is, when I watched it, I basically did not feel like I was sat there for that length of time. You know, it just sort of, you know, because the story, you know, because the, you know, and it's a very dialogue heavy film because it's sort of so enclosed. But even, you know, even with the sort of, you know, because there's so many different characters who were interacting with each other, and you were sort of like, you know, learning, you know, there was some sort of tension because you knew not everyone was who they say they was, you know, but was sort of, it was almost like the Reservoir Dog thing where you're trying to work out who's the rat. You know, somebody in this film, you know, wasn't what they seemed. Somebody was working against them. And, it was just sort of, it was, you know, for me, it was just a, you know, a fascinating film to watch.
Yeah, now, I'm surprised, considering you weren't a big fan of Death Proof, but you said, you just mentioned earlier, it's like, well, it manages to bounce around enough to where you don't really get that just characters talking, in one location, and it wears on you. I'm curious, I feel like we're wrapping up this discussion, but, as we're, sort of, I guess, putting a bow tie on this show, I feel like, I have to go back to Death Proof. It's like, so wait, you didn't like Death Proof, but did you like that one scene in Reservoir Dogs where it's one of those things where you can sort of just watch it and forgive it? Or I'm curious to see. It's like, how do you justify hating one film, but one film had a scene that was very similar to it, but I guess maybe because it didn't take up so much of the screen time?
It's execution. Ah. You know, the scene in Reservoir Dogs. I can watch any scene of any kind in any film that's done really well. But the scene in Reservoir Dogs where they basically just sat around the coffee shop table and talking, I think it's basically just really, really well done with the dialogue. It's funny in places, but all the characters shine through. They're actually, even though they're talking about pretty much nothing, you know, talking about like, you know, Madonna songs or tipping, it's done, you know, the dialogue is done that well, is that it's gripping what we're talking about. It's fun to listen to them. The scene in Death Proof was just a really, real, for a start, I don't think it was particularly well acted. And I don't think the characters were particularly, had much to, you know, to them to sort of, you know, to shine through. But generally speaking, the actual, what they were talking about was just sort of long and boring. You know, that was the thing, that, you know, what they were saying, you know, was of no interest to me. You know, again, and even, you know, in like, you know, just going back to this film, you know, The Hateful Eight, there's lots and lots of, you know, scenes on there which are just talking, but they're all talking about things which are interesting. There's some sort of personality to the characters. There's something that holds you. In Death Proof, and, you know, and also in sort of, Django Unchained at the end, what they were talking about was just dull. You know, but there's, you know, to me, the same, the similar sort of scenes, but they are massively, far apart when it comes to the actual dialogue and the entertainment value and how well they're acted as well. To me, it's kind of like saying that, you know, if you see like a really, really long fight scene in one film, that's the same as like a really, really, you know, as a really, really good fight scene in another film. Mm. You know, both of them can be like, you know, one could be really well done and another one not really well done. It's just, you know, although the scenes are similar, they're totally different when it comes to the actual execution and everything.
But if I may peel back the curtain just a little bit, I want to let everybody know. Now, when we were initially setting our show up a while back for this show, I asked Dazza, so are we going to do this show and then go into our normal, usual Tales from the Couch Zone show? Because I'm like, oh, okay, we're going to talk Quentin Tarantino movies, but really, realistically, how long are we going to talk about that? An hour, 90 minutes here? I'm looking at the record time here, and we're looking at 100... Well, an hour and 55 minutes, probably by the time we wrap this bad boy up, 2 hours. So
I told you.
I didn't think that was going to happen because I'm looking at even my show rundown. I was like, okay, we got maybe 15, 18 films tops. It's like there's no way we're going to fill 2 hours. We're going to want to do our top Quentin Tarantino movies, and then we're going to go on the usual show where we talk Raid and Slay, and then everything you've been reading and watching as a lay. And it's like, okay, that I can see sort of padded out to maybe 2 hours and change, maybe 2 hours and a half. But as I live and breathe and we record this show, we're already steadily going towards 2 hours here. So,
yeah.
Is there anything?
I know us. When we get talking, we just talk and talk and talk. Which is rather ironic because I complain about Death Proof having sort of like sat around and basically talking about absolutely nothing, and then we basically just talk for 2 hours about Tarantino movies.
I love these specialty shows. I think we need to make them a more regular instance. Obviously, I can't put a guarantee and say, oh, we're going to do this every single month. We're going to do our regular Tales from the Couch Zone, and then we're going to interrupt it with a specialty show. But considering we did this for Halloween, we did this for our top favorite fictional presidents, I sort of like that we're doing this. We're sort of varying the show as we're increasing the variety of what we do here at halfguard.com, as well as Tales from the Couch Zone. So I appreciate Dazza for coming up with these great ideas because they make for some fun, interesting shows.
I think there's a lot more of these to come because I've got quite a lot of ideas, you know, for this, for doing like the as top tens in the future and stuff. So I think we're going to be getting these on a regular basis from now on.
There you go. All right, Dazza, unless there's anything you want to talk about before we wrap this show up, by all means.
Only thing I just want to say is what should be jumping up on Half Guarded anytime soon will be my Invicta 20 recap. I did the Invicta preview before the show on Friday, and I always, as tradition, I always do a preview show and a recap show of the show, and so that will basically be dropping sometime this week. And I've got a few ideas for some writing, which will, be coming up soon.
Okay, it's not really appropriate considering the discussion we had on this show, but I feel like I want to discuss it now because by next week I don't know how much I'll care, and it won't be too pertinent concerning how much time has gone by. But I noticed you commented on Roxanne's Modafferi, I guess, statement on weight cutting. Now, what exactly happened there? Because I didn't get all the facts. I'm curious, and you can sort of discuss it here as well.
Yeah, okay. I mean, I actually go into this in the recap. What actually happened is on Friday before the Invicta show, at the weigh-ins, there were three fighters that missed weight. And didn't miss weight by a little bit. They missed by a lot. And I think why Roxanne Modafferi basically sort of, mentioned it is that one of her teammates and friends, Jessica Rose Clark, the fighter that she was fighting basically missed weight. I think she basically missed it by about 4 pounds mm-hmm. or something. So she, I mean, basically Roxanne's argument is that as a fighter, it's up to you to basically make weight. And it's basically, there should be some sort of penalty for you missing weight. And basically, and it's, it's one of those things that, you know, you can say it's only a when it comes to the scheme of thing, you know, sort of, you know, being a bit over, you know, higher up on the weight probably doesn't make a big deal. But, you know, weight divisions are there for a reason, but to make the basically, you know, the fight as fair as, you know, as possible, you know, when it comes to size and, you know, and that sort of thing. And it was just sort of, you know, the point I made is that, and the reason I know this is I was researching Jessica Rose Clark's previous fights, and in the fight before this one, she actually fought someone else in Australia who was, I think, was about like 5 pounds over, you know, so she went into a disadvantage. And they actually had a system where if you miss weight by a certain amount, then the fight still goes ahead, but you basically are deducted either a point or 2 points if it's like a really, but to go into the fight with. So you basically are penalised in the actual fight for missing weight. So that was basically just sort of, you know, where that's what actually happened on that occasion.
Okay. I was just curious because, like, I saw the discussion and it's like, I have to talk to him now and I have to talk to him on this week's show because by next week, I'm not going to care. It's not going to be that big a deal. So, and it's not going to be super pertinent. It's not going to be super, I know, relevant. So I just thought we'll get it now out of the way. And we're already done with the Quentin Tarantino stuff and we're wrapping this show up. So I feel like this is as good a place as any to talk about that. So, all right.
Yeah. I kind of do go over that in the preview because it was there was quite a few controversial moments on this show, on the Invictus show. So, but, you know, read the article for my take on that.
All right, so I'll be sure to mention. I believe that's already up on halfguard.com or not yet.
I only did it this morning. So
I'm looking right here in Invicta UFC 20. Nope, it's here.
Oh, it's so perfect. All right, okay, that's cool.
Okay, so if you haven't already checked that out, if you like all things Invicta, all right, I think that's going to do it for this week's show. So from all of us at halfguard.com, thanks for checking out this special show, and as always, check you guys out next week. Adios. Bye. We'll be right back.